Previously on Beta.
Grace Slick. Marty Balin. Paul Kentner. Jorma. Something. These are the members of the airplane.
Yeah, well, people have had a lot of reaction to the Roaches. I mean, they think it's like a punk kind of name or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's our real last name.
Now you're drowsy, Jesus. They've pricked you full of Thorazine. They've given you electroconvulsive therapy. You don't know where you are.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, we explore the evolution of the Coen Brothers films.
I think that now, as they've gotten older, they deal with mortality in a way that I find quite serious. Not humorless, right? And not ponderous or pretentious, but not funny.
Film critic Adam Naiman joins us to talk about Joel and Ethan Coen's cinematic vision. Also, Suzy Roach of the Roaches reflects on the memory of her sister, Maggie.
I think Maggie was extremely sensitive, which was part of her brilliance as a songwriter, but it also caused her a lot of trouble because walking through the world could be a painful experience for her.
Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya is pushing satire as far as it can go with his debut short story collection, Friday Black. He explores the violence, injustice, and painful absurdities that confront African Americans. Friday Black has been described as Black Mirror meets Black Lives Matter, but Nana has a different elevator pitch. I should warn you that part of our conversation contains violent imagery.
If you imagine three people sitting on a couch, and the first is like, you know, I really like this. It's really soft, you know, pretty good butt feel. It's like, feels pretty great. And the second's like, yeah, I also think this couch is like pretty awesome. You know, I feel like the lumbar is good, but it's just, you know, it feels really great for me just, you know, relax into it. And the third is like, yes, I also agree that the couch is nice, but I think we're overlooking the fact that it's made out of corpses. That's kind of what this book is.
Yeah, that's really good. Did you just come up with that recently?
No, someone asked me to sort of describe the book without summarizing it in any way, and that was the best I could come up with.
That's really good, I think. That's a great description. In his review of your book, David Canfield says that Friday Black is part of a new pop culture trend that he calls New Black Surrealism, and he also says that it's in the same vein as movies like Get Out and Sorry to Bother You, as well as Donald Glover projects like Atlanta and This Is America. Canfield says that all of these works gain political power from a kind of absurdist framing. Would you agree with that?
I do think that there is sort of a absurdist framing, but I think that and that framing comes from the absurdity that is racism itself, the absurdity that is the way oppression just forces humans to do the opposite of what you would hope and expect them to do with each other. And the comparisons, I think, make sense. I wrote this book before Get Out came out, you know, several years before Get Out came out, actually. But I remember going to the theaters and being like, good, you know, this is allowed now, almost. If they're going to call it a trend, I don't know if I would agree with that word per se, but part of that is just the powers that be in the media being more open to allowing Black creators to tell their stories in different ways. This kind of thing has existed before. It's just, I think now some people are realizing they can maybe monetize it, and so now we're seeing it more.
Yeah. The first story in Friday Black is called The Finkelstein Five. I'd like to have you read the opening of it, please.
Absolutely. Fila, the headless girl, walked toward Emmanuel, her neck jagged with red savagery. She was silent, but he could feel her waiting for him to do something. Anything. Then his phone rang and he woke up. He took a deep breath and set the blackness in his voice down to a 1.5 on a 10-point scale. Hi there, how are you doing today? Yes, yes, I did recently inquire about the status of my application. Well, all right. Okay. Great to hear. I'll be there. Have a spectacular day. Manuel rolled out of bed and brushed his teeth. His house was quiet. His parents had already left for work. That morning, like every morning, the first decision he made regarded his blackness. His skin was a deep, constant brown. In public, when people could actually see him, it was impossible to get his blackness down anywhere near 1.5. If he wore a tie, wingtip shoes, smiled constantly, used his indoor voice, and kept his hands strapped and calm at his sides, he could get his blackness as low as 4.0. Though Emmanuel was happy about scoring the interview, he also felt guilty about feeling happy about anything. Most people he knew were still mourning the Finkelstein verdict. After 28 minutes of deliberation, a jury of his peers had acquitted George Wilson Dunn of any wrongdoing whatsoever. He had been indicted for allegedly using a chainsaw to hack off the heads of 5 black children outside the Finkelstein Library in Valley Ridge, South Carolina. The court had ruled that, because the children were basically loitering and were not actually inside the library reading as one might expect of productive members of society, it was reasonable that Dunn had felt threatened by these 5 black young people, and thus, he was well within his rights when he protected himself, his library loan DVDs, and his children by going into the back of his Ford F-150 and retrieving his Hawtech Pro 18-inch 48cc chainsaw.
Thank you. This idea of a white man using a chainsaw to saw the heads off of 5 black children is so horrifying, and it's so violent. It seems like such an exaggeration, and yet the more I thought about it when I first read the story, the more it didn't seem like as much of an exaggeration as I would like it to. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. I think a lot of my stories operate right in that space between familiar and hyperbole, but also I think part of the reason for the chainsaw is that you can't ignore it. The way, unfortunately, it's almost become something to ignore young black people being murdered by a gun, for example. You know, for me, whether you kill someone with a chainsaw, a pickaxe, or a gun, they're just as dead either way. And I think this story sort of pushes on that idea that this killing is happening gruesomely all the time, actually. Maybe not by chainsaw, but like, how bad does it have to be for us to really take notice?
Yeah, that chainsaw really gets your attention, as well as the fact that the guy is using it on 5 black children. Mm-hmm. You also introduced this idea of code switching in the story, the idea of changing the kind of language you use when you're communicating with people from different cultural backgrounds. In the Finkelstein 5, your main character, Emmanuel, sets the blackness in his voice to various points on a 10-point scale, depending on who he's talking to. It makes me think of Boots Riley's film, Sorry to Bother You. And you actually, I noticed when you did the reading, you kind of did modify the voice to suit the character. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit about this idea of code switching and why you decided to make it so literal, use this 10-point scale in the story?
Yeah, often my way into something like surrealism is by concretizing and literalizing something that I think is an abstract or mental experience. And so I think many black people are familiar with the idea of code switching. Again, you know, I wrote this story several years before Sorry to Bother You came out, but I think it's like, seeing it in different places shows like, you know, it's kind of a thing that the black community at large understands and knows. That is, depending on where you are, things that might typically be associated with your being black can be used against you, can be used to deny you things, and also can be used to make you a threat. And so in this story, the main character, Emmanuel, just his voice, not only his voice, but also his appearance, but also his like aura, a whole bunch of things on a 10-point scale. And I use a 10-point scale because in that literalizing, concretizing, it sort of becomes also, again, a little bit absurd because, you know, I think blackness is not quantifiable. You know, blackness is so many different things. But the stereotype of blackness, the fear that people fear regarding blackness is silly and reducible and based on things that aren't real. And so the scale allows me to play with the idea of adjusting yourself to appease someone else's gaze based on a paradigm that is inherently false in the first place.
Yeah. If you don't mind my asking, do you yourself ever adjust the blackness in your voice? Do you code switch?
I think I absolutely code switch. You know, I think if I was talking to my friends versus in this interview, it would sound very different.
Can you quantify what setting you're at doing this interview?
No, because, you know, there is no real setting. Again, just from moving through the world, I think if you're black, there's so many different ways you're going to have to adjust mm-hmm. yourself to be presentable. And it's not just black people. I think so many different people from so many different spaces and identities have to sort of shave away parts of themselves to present as whatever it might be to be successful, upwardly mobile, or even just safe in any particular space. And so, yeah, no, for me, I'm sure I do. And what's fortunate is I think as I get further into something like success or something like maturity, I'm allowed to do it way less. Fortunately, I get to be myself 100% a lot more than I used to, and eventually I think I'll get to be myself all the time. And we'll see.
I've read that Ishmael Reed's 1972 novel, Mumbo Jumbo, had a very dramatic impact on you. In fact, you've said that reading this book kind of exploded your head. How so?
Yeah, I read Mumbo Jumbo, and you talked about sort of, I can't remember what you said, it was called the, quote, trend of black realism? Is that what they call it?
Oh, the David Canfield quote, it was, yeah, what he called new black surrealism, yeah.
Ishmael Reed was doing a lot of things all those people you mentioned are doing in that book. I didn't realize prior to that you could be sort of so funny and, you know, I guess surreal and strange and perhaps even irreverent when talking about a black experience or racism or any of those things or issues that were serious. And I think Ishmael Reed did that artfully and in ways that were interesting to me. You know, I like authors who sort of, in reading them, I sort of feel more powerful in that they show me, like, this is allowed, this is possible, this is the thing that can be done. And that book certainly did that for me.
Yeah, so I'm guessing something like the aborted fetuses that come back to confront their father in your story, Lark Street, that would be kind of an example of how Ishmael Reed's Mumbo Jumbo allowed you to let your imagination go as far as possible?
Yeah, I actually might have started that story before I read Mumbo Jumbo, to be honest, but sometimes it's confirmation, you know, of what you've already, like, thought you might wanted to do, but were afraid to fully commit to.
Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya's debut short story collection is called Friday Black. You can find out more about Nana and hear him read an excerpt from the title story at wpr.org/Bateman.
She said, thank you for being here. And I said, of course, I love you. And that was the last exchange we had.
Suzzy Roach of The Roaches on the loss of her sister Maggie. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta. Maggie Roach passed away in 2017 after a long battle with cancer. Maggie was a member of the innovative folk trio, The Roaches, along with her sisters, Terry and Suzzy. The Roaches created distinctive harmonies together for almost 40 years with songs like this one. It's called Malachies.
Eddie said the beat was wrong. Tom didn't like the tune. The boy with the beard in the corner laughed in the middle of the song. He didn't stay very long.
Now Suzzy has compiled a collection of songs by Maggie called Where Do I Come From?
Well, it really took me about a year until I was ready to try to do it. When Maggie died in the last couple of weeks, she asked me to do something with her music. And, you know, then she died, and then 4 months later my mother died. And so the whole year was just, you know, a complete, you know, black time for me. And it wasn't until the next year that I actually started to think, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
And so Dick Kinnett from Story Sound Records told me that he would help me.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I began the process of going through all the material and all the music that she had left and trying to put together something that I felt would represent her life's work.
Where Do I Come From features four previously unreleased recordings, including the title track. Can you tell me about how you found this song?
Well, I had many, many boxes of tapes, cassettes, and other things that I took from her apartment. And I went through everything, and I found that little song. I think it was probably the last song she wrote. It was very recent, and I just was so struck by it.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful song. It has this, to my ears, it has a really wistful, melancholic feel. And I'm thinking especially about the very last two lines.
No one seems to hear the beat.
What's your take on this song?
Well, I do think that Maggie was, you know, having a very hard time in the last few years of her life. She was ill, mm-hmm. and she didn't tell anyone. And I think she felt very alone. But I also know that she was very interested in the refugee crisis around the world and the migrants. And I know that because I found also among her things all these places where she was donating. So I think part of her really identified with the feeling of being misplaced and or displaced from her own life. You know?
Another one of the previously unreleased songs is a song called Down the Dream. Can you tell me about this one?
Yeah, that song is actually was recorded for the record Seductive Reasoning, but this recording of it was a live recording in the studio. And the story, as I heard it, was that Maggie and Terry were over in England making a record, and the record company called and had heard some of the tapes they were making and said, "We don't really care for them, so come home." And I think that recording was made the night that they got that news.
Stopped to leave at the entrance to the highway. The leg of an underpair.
How does this previously unreleased version of Down the Dream, how is it different from the version that's on the Seductive Reasoning album?
Well, it's got a lot of different lyrics, and also it's probably about twice as long and very, very spaced out. But you really hear Maggie singing freely, and I think one of the things about Maggie was she always wanted to be free. And when you're making records and dealing with record companies and everything, it's very hard to do that.
Yeah. There's something about siblings and the way that they're able to harmonize so beautifully, and the Roaches are a perfect example. Do you have any ideas, any theories about why you and your sister's voices blend so well?
I think it's just, in our case, something that we did from such an early age that it's still hard for me to sing by myself. I kind of crave the physical sensation of singing in harmony. And we were very, very strict about rehearsing and making sure it was all very perfect. And I don't think that that's something that regularly happens. We were almost like a choir.
Yeah, that's true. And is that part of, like, your harmonies have been described as unusual?
You can go south in winter, be what you are.
Yes, because we were very untrained for the most part. And so we were just going note by note, and everybody would get a note. Or sometimes Maggie would come in with a complete arrangement. And I also hear things in harmony just naturally. I kind of like what the three parts do to the voice of a song, because it sort of removes one personality and gives it a little bit of distance.
Sure. Maggie had an unusual contralto voice, almost a baritone. How would you describe the way her voice fit into the sound of the Roaches?
Well, she definitely has had various distinctive low end to her voice, but she also could go very high. Mm-hmm. She just was naturally gifted in that way, and she also had an uncanny knack for harmony.
In a story for the New York Times Magazine, after Maggie died, John Lincoln described Maggie's songs as, quote, vignettes of emotional hypersensitivity, end quote. What do you think of that description?
I think Maggie was extremely sensitive, which was part of her brilliance as a songwriter, but it also caused her a lot of trouble. Because walking through the world could be a painful experience for her.
You said that Maggie thought differently from other people and that she seemed to always be coming up against conventions. Can you talk a bit about that and how that sort of sense of outsiderness kind of found its way into her songs?
Yes, well, she has always been very unconventional, even as a little kid. She was always coming up against the rules and the authorities. You know, she wanted to be free, and she wanted to be free to express herself without being categorized. She thought differently. I mean, one of the great, wonderful joys of my life has been that I was privy to Maggie's conversation. When she was very shy, but when she was with somebody that she trusted, she would just talk and talk and talk, and she had the most unusual point of view. And her writing is just, I mean, I always felt that her songs were just, there was just something about them that was, you kind of can recognize greatness. Mm-hmm. And I think that if she had been a solo performer, she may have gotten more of attention than she got being in the group. Yeah. But I don't think she had this strength really to go out alone in the world.
Mm-hmm. It seems that Maggie wrote a lot of songs about the relationships between men and women and what it was like to be a woman during the 1970s. I'm thinking especially of songs like Underneath the Moon, The Married Man, and This Feminine Position.
We can discuss the menu. We can
Yes, I think Maggie was a fierce feminist, actually, but she wouldn't probably describe herself with that kind of label. But she, you know, we grew up in a family where we were not told that women were less than men. Mm-hmm. And so when we got out into the world and realized, oh, that's not the way it always works, I think it really hit hard. And also the Roaches, we were, you know, fierce when we came out of the gate.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then we ran up against, once again, conventions. And we were very unconventional.
Yeah.
And then you can kind of see as Maggie got older that she softened and her philosophy became wider, I think, and, you know, more mature.
Mm-hmm. And yet there's this other side to Maggie in the sense that she'd also write a song like My Winter Coat.
The fit is generous and loose. The coat is filled with down of goose. Should I feel guilty about that? I wouldn't wear the fur of a cat.
Is this song an example of Maggie thinking differently from other people?
I would say so.
Yeah.
You know, that coat, she wrote this 8-minute song about a coat, but that coat was everything to her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she really loved the coat.
Yeah.
And it's so funny. You know, she knew every detail of that coat, obviously. It's funny, but it's also dead serious.
One of the most beautiful Roaches songs is the Hammond song, which was written by Maggie, and it's from your 1979 self-titled debut album, which was produced by Robert Fripp of King Crimson fame. He also plays guitar on the album. And because the instrumentation on this song is kind of sparse, it really shows off your harmonies.
Come on, you're into me.
What is the Hammond song about?
Well, I don't like to presume to interpret Maggie's songs, mm-hmm. but I think what happened was there was a period of time after Maggie and Terry made Seductive Reasoning where, you know, it was sort of considered a failure in the world, even though it's a classic now.
Oh, yeah.
They went down to Hammond, Louisiana, and lived in a sort of a kung fu temple, which I also went down there, and Maggie and I had jobs at a truck stop, and Terry worked at the local diner. And I think my parents were not happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think probably that song came out of that experience.
In 1990, you, Terry, and Maggie released the holiday album We Three Kings, and Maggie wrote a song for the album called Christmas Love, but she didn't write it in time to make it on the album. So you and other members of your family have recorded it especially for this new compilation album. Can you tell me a bit about this song?
Yeah, that was kind of a miraculous moment in the project, because I was looking through all of her things for mm-hmm. that song and I couldn't find it. And then out of the blue one day, I got an email from, you know, a Roaches fan, and he asked me, he said, I heard this song once, and it really helped me through a terrible time, and it was about Christmas. Mm. And I wrote back and I said, oh yeah, that's Maggie's Christmas song. Unfortunately, I can't find it. He said, I have a tape of it.
Ah.
And he had somehow, I guess it was on the radio, I think we only performed it once,
mm-hmm.
and he had this tape. And so he sent it to me, and I was able to relearn the song. The recording wasn't good enough to use, but so that was kind of a magical sign along the way that this was a good idea.
The cold, it is clear.
Favorite Maggie Roach song? That's a tough question because she's written so many great songs, but is there one that really resonates with you more than any other song?
Well, yes, actually. I think the masterpiece of Maggie's is a song called A Dove, and it's on the record called A Dove. And she, to me, every time I listen to that song, I'm amazed by what it's saying and the poetry of it and the beauty of the arrangement, everything about it. I think that that's kind of a pinnacle of her work.
A dove settled on a sill, and I called my cat. Love, if looks could kill, and that was that.
Do you have a favorite memory of Maggie that you can share with us?
Oh, well, I have so many, yeah. many wonderful memories of Maggie. We had so many laughs and so many ridiculous things happened, you know, through many years. But the last 2 months of her life, we really, really got to spend so much wonderful time together, quiet time. Just I would bring her over a blueberry muffin every morning. And then, you know, the very last moment of her consciousness, the last thing that she said to me was, thank you. She said, thank you for being here. And I said, well, that's of course, I love you. And that was the last exchange we had. So that is very still fresh in my mind, even though it's almost 2 years ago.
That was Suzy Roach of the Roaches reflecting on her late sister Maggie. Suzy has compiled a collection of Maggie's work for a new album called Where Do I Come From? You can find out more about Suzy and Maggie at WPR.org/beta.
It's like their personality almost disappears into the genre. Like when they make a film like Miller's Crossing, you can tell it's them because it's complicated and because it's smart, but they really are kind of working in the spirit of Dashiell Hammett there.
Up next, film critic Adam Neyman shares his grand unified theory of what really ties the Coen brothers' films together.
That rug really tied the room together, did it not?
No, it's not the rug. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta.
I'm not sure that I agree with you 100% on your police work there, Lou.
If the rule you followed brought you to this, of what use was the rule?
Hell, I'd get you towed by 3 o'clock this afternoon with nail polish.
What do a pregnant cop, a Vietnam vet, and a serial killer all have in common? They're some of the most memorable characters in movie history, and they all come from the minds of Joel and Ethan Coen. Film critic Adam Neyman is the author of The Coen Brothers. This book really ties the films together. It's a comprehensive look at their entire filmography. Adam points to one single shot from the 2009 film, A Serious Man, that captures the scope of their cinematic universe.
Larry Gopnik, who's this not quite tenured physics professor in the 1960s in suburban Minneapolis, is talking to his students about this sort of really complicated theorem, and he just keeps sketching equations and division on the blackboard sort of beyond not just the student's ability but his ability to understand it. And then there's a cut and the camera pulls back and you see that the equation is sort of surreally large.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's a funny image in terms of how abstract and intellectual he and his job are, but also just as a kind of a little representation of, you know, us versus the bigger questions.
Delta P equals the square root of 0.077 A squared H over A squared and 1.74 H bar, okay? The uncertainty principle. It proves we can't ever really know what's going on.
Within the movie, it signifies something about that character and his existential dilemma, but I definitely used it as a way of illustrating my own, sort of like the determination to sort through and connect the movies and also the feeling that it might be too daunting a task.
Mm-hmm. Your book has a great subtitle, This Book Really Ties the Films Together, which is, of course, a riff on the famous line from The Big Lebowski. That rug really tied the room together. You mention the idea of a grand unified theory of Coen-ness. Have you been able to come up with this unified theory that really ties all of the Coen brothers' films together?
Well, I guess the joke is that the grand unified theory can't be expressed in anything less than, you know, 70,000 words, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The same way that the professor can't
sure.
distill it down to 1A plus B equals C.
Sure, to paraphrase Jaws, we're going to need a bigger blackboard.
Yeah, we're going to need a bigger blackboard. We're going to need a bigger book. That's very funny.
Exactly, yeah.
I like that. Jaws, one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, it's a classic.
But, I mean, in terms of a grand theory, I would say more that it's kind of about, like, motifs within motifs and themes within themes and things that they sort of return to. And I think that recurrence and circularity are things that their movies are often about.
Mm-hmm.
And recurrence and circularity are also things that I think define their career. They often come back to certain things. I don't think that means that they retreat, or I don't think it means that they move backwards. I just think that they like to consider some of these ideas or some of these problems from a variety of different angles, which is why on the surface, their movies have such a pleasing sense of difference. They're not terribly alike one another, but structurally, in a deep way, I think they're all quite similar. Not to the point of being redundant, I think to the point of being maybe obsessive.
Yeah, and this idea of circles that you mentioned, you say that the circle is the central Coen motif. Can you talk about that?
Sure, it's one of them. I mean, a really obvious, not, I'm when I say obvious, I don't mean that it's you know, basic or stupid or anything.
No,
like that.
No.
I just think it's a very simple one is in the Hudsucker Proxy,
mm-hmm.
which is a comedy about the idea of what if someone literally reinvents the wheel, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And this Tim Robbins character, you know, inventing the hula hoop seems to have tapped into something really profound when it's something quite simple. But, you know, you also have, you know, the tumbleweed in the Big Lebowski, which is mm-hmm. on the one hand, very incongruous. I mean, what is a tumbleweed doing in California? It's like a Western has rolled into a film noir.
Mm-hmm.
But when you combine the tumbleweed also with the bowling ball in Lebowski and just this sense of kind of rolling along at your own ambling pace, it's very tied to the movements of Jeff Bridges' character and to the larger triumph that the Bridges character has, which is that idea of his paternity and putting a little Lebowski into the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You argue that this circularity, it even extends to the music in the Brothers films. You interviewed Carter Burwell, who has composed 15 of Joel and Ethan Coen's movies, and you talked to him about the circular score of their debut film, Blood Simple, and also Fargo, in which the main theme, this folky theme, keeps returning to itself. What did he have to say about the circular nature of the music he's created?
I should say Carter Burwell is one of about a half dozen collaborators the Coens have had. He's been working with them since Blood Simple. And he articulated quite brilliantly the way certain of his scores work in a circular way. You know, Blood Simple has this little piano riff that almost subconsciously you keep waiting for it to fill itself out and start again. It's this very creeping, insinuating piece of music. Or how in Fargo, it's this kind of little circular folk riff that then expands outward into this bombastic second go-around. That the first one is modest, which ties into the smallness of the story, and the second one is epic, which has to do with maybe the outsized greed of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that even something like O Brother, Where Art Thou deals with circularity in music in an interesting way, where an old song becomes a hit in the present tense.
Mm-hmm.
Or in Inside Llewyn Davis, he has the line, if it's not new and it never gets old, it's a folk song.
Yeah.
Which is a very circular kind of reasoning about how either certain works endure or mm-hmm. taste moves in cycles of fads and popularity.
Yeah, very well said. And yes, as you mentioned, the Coens like are really great at playing with genre structure. And it seems to me that they have this uncanny ability to take these old Hollywood movie genres and tropes and then make them their own to, in effect, Coenize them.
Very often.
Yeah, how do they do that? How do they accomplish that?
Well, I mean, I'd be one of many people who'd have an opinion on that. I mean, I think that when you look at Blood Simple, one of the things they did was they dragged the 40s noir mentality into the 80s by use of kind of very spatter horror movie gore,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
Or in Raising Arizona, they take a Preston Sturges structure, and they tie it to a kind of Reagan-era economic desperation and class division.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes they almost, it's like their personality almost disappears into the genre. Like when they make a film like Miller's Crossing, you can tell it's them because it's complicated and because it's smart, but they really are kind of like working in the spirit of Dashiell Hammett there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the really interesting tensions in their work is always between them asserting a certain identity, which has become more and more familiar as they've made movies for 35 years, and also honoring aspects of what they're working in. No Country for Old Men is a great example of that, for instance.
Well, we need to know what we're calling it for here.
You need to call it. I can't call it for you. Well, it wouldn't be fair.
I didn't put nothing up.
Yes, you did. You've been putting it up your whole life. You just didn't know it. You know what date is on this coin?
No.
1958. It's been traveling 22 years to get here. And now it's here. And it's either heads or tails. And you have to say, call it.
Well, look, I need to know what I stand to win.
Everything.
How's that?
You stand to win everything, call it.
You know, in No Country for Old Men, they're completely faithful to Cormac McCarthy's plot and his characters and even his language. They joked when they won the Oscar that all they did was hold the book open and copy it to write the script. But at the same time, there are little variations, even just the haircut that they give Javier Bardem or the way that Kelly MacDonald's character gets to be a voice of defiance towards the end of the movie that are very, very much theirs, and I think can be tied to other films, but also just are not deferring to the source text.
You say that on a strictly technical level, No Country for Old Men is possibly the most fully realized, fully accomplished, I should say, of Joel and Ethan Coen's films. How so?
I've come to think that, and I mean, again, it's in some ways hard to rank these things, and also, you know, form follows function, so the ways that all their movies are made in different ways suit what they're about.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that there is a tightness and a speed in a way to No Country for Old Men, even though it doesn't feel like a fast film in terms of being frenetically edited or paced. There's a speed and a clarity and an absolute precision of expression in that film that not only do I think ranks high in their body of work, I have a hard time thinking of too many thrillers that can match it, period.
Yeah.
There's something about the propulsion it has while also leaving space for these metaphysical things to percolate that I think is quite remarkable. And I also think in some ways the reason It and Fargo are their two most penetrative movies in terms of the mainstream consciousness, in terms of people embracing them, is because in some ways they're very empty.
Mm-hmm.
And by empty, I don't mean simple or dumb. I just mean they don't have a lot of movie references in them.
Yeah.
Blood Simple, Fargo, and No Country are far more spacious in that way than, say, Hudsucker and Lebowski are.
You taught an 8-week course about the Coen brothers' films at the Miles Nadel. Am I saying that right?
Nadel? Yeah, correct.
Yeah, Jewish Community Center in Toronto back in 2013. It was called The Coen Brothers in Neyman's Terms, which is a great title. Why did you choose the Coen brothers?
I mean, I think if you watch American films, without having to necessarily be a cinephile or a working critic, they're probably on your radar because they're not obscure, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're popular enough in terms of teaching a course or frankly writing a book that people are going to be interested. But the question of whether or not they're mainstream is, I think, an interesting debate. I would argue that in some ways they've bent aspects of the mainstream to suit them, or they've bent aspects of the mainstream to meet them on their terms. That wasn't the case for the first four or five films when they struggled to find a popular audience.
Yeah.
But I think Fargo and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou and No Country have proved that they can, and True Grit especially, that they can command a popular audience in the moment, whereas Lebowski proves that, you know, they also have it in them to be cult filmmakers, because that film, I think, supersedes all their other movies in terms of after-the-fact popularity.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Almost to the point where, despite the fact that it is my personal favorite of their films, and I'll say that on the record, it's also become one of their annoying films in terms of how culturally omnipresent it is.
Yes.
And I almost find myself sometimes apologizing to certain friends that I'm doing a screening of Lebowski or talking about it, not because I think the film demands an apology, but because it's become such a dorm room staple.
Yeah.
And that was not how it played in 1998.
Yeah. Yeah, you actually say in your book, you write that the Big Lebowski is their sweetest film and that it might be the only one of their movies that has an unequivocally happy ending. So do you think that's why the Big Lebowski has this huge cult following and has inspired Lebowski Fest and is so present in our culture?
There is something so deeply funny in the idea of a 60s radical and a kind of John Milius type reactionary Vietnam vet or someone who has at least styled himself that way.
Yeah.
Not just being best friends, but like needing each other to get through the day.
This is $180.
It is our most modestly priced receptacle.
$180?
They range up to $3,000.
Can't
we just rent it from you? Yeah.
So this is a mortuary, not a rental house.
But just because we're bereaved doesn't make us sad!
Sir, please lower your voices.
Man, don't you have, you know, something else we can put him in, you know?
That is our most modestly priced receptacle.
Is there a Ralph's around here?
Like, that's not a joke that you tell, like, knock, knock, who's there. That is like a deep core joke that is funny.
Yeah.
Or even when you come to realize, you know, what it means in terms of those little Lebowski urban achievers that the Big Lebowski talks about being kind of like ersatz offspring, and this whole movie is about the dude having a real kid of his own.
Yeah, yeah.
Like these things are quite hilarious and touching and sweet. They're not necessarily evident on a first viewing. I think that while all their films improve on multiple viewings, none of them improve as much the 10th, 12th, 15th time you see it, like Lebowski does.
Yeah, yeah, very well said. What do you think it is that makes the Coen brothers' film so rewatchable?
I think it's that attention to detail. I think it's that incredible quality of acting that they get. With a couple of exceptions, maybe, and people's mileage may vary, I can't think of a Coen film that on the whole is anything but extremely well acted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes actors let films down, but I think I could count on like one hand the number of times that's happened with them.
Yeah.
And the other thing I'd say that makes them rewatchable, this might sound a little basic, but their movies tend to be pretty short, you know, with the exception of True Grit and No Country and Buster Scruggs, they've barely made anything that scrapes 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they also have a lot of high points, like quotable dialogue or exciting moments that you kind of look forward to watching again.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Well, one of the themes that you point out that can be found in nearly every Coen Brothers film is a kind of fear or uncertainty about the future.
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about that and how it affects their audiences, the people who watch
the
films?
Sure. It was one of the things in writing the book that I felt very interesting because we're talking about uncertainty, but I felt very certain that it's in there.
Mm.
And it hasn't really been discussed that much, that on the one hand, people often think that they are filmmakers who retreat into the past or into genre because they don't want to deal with the present. But I think it's more that, you know, even when their films are set in the past, their characters are talking about the future, like dry cleaning represents the future in The Man Who Wasn't There.
Yeah.
Or at the end of A Brother, Where Art Thou, George Clooney says, don't worry, there's an age of reason coming.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Fargo, which is one of their present tense movies, ends with Frances McDormand saying 2 more months because she's about to have a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in all of those cases, there's an optimism there that is underpinned by real dread about what's coming next. And then you have endings like the ending of A Serious Man or the ending of No Country for Old Men, where that dread seems really justified based on what we see either coming over the horizon or in the case of No Country, not coming. Because the only thing scarier than what the future might hold is realizing that you don't have much future left.
Loretta tells me you're quitting. How come you're doing that?
I don't know. I feel overmatched.
What you got ain't nothing new. This country's hard on people. You can't stop what's coming. It ain't all waiting on you. That's vanity.
Their recent films, including the one that they've made now for Netflix, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, they're death-tinged in a way that their early movies weren't. I think their early movies had death in them as a plot point and murder and violence because that's the model that they're working in.
Mm-hmm.
I think that now, as they've gotten older, they deal with mortality in a way that I find quite serious. Not humorless, right?
Mm-hmm.
And not ponderous or pretentious, but not funny.
No.
And, you know, but then just to, you know, to lighten it up a bit, I mean, in something like Hail Caesar, it's hilarious that both the military industrial complex trying to hire Josh Brolin away from the movie studio and the communist screenwriters trying to extort the movie studio, both in their pitches talk about the future, right?
Yeah.
So who's the future going to belong to is kind of what this movie is asking, even though it seems to be just a slapstick comedy backstage in a movie studio. This idea of the future is built right in.
Adam Neyman is the author of The Coen Brothers. This book really ties the films together. And I think that this interview really tied the show together. What do you think? Let us know by sending an email to beta@wpr.org. And while you're at it, let us know what your favorite Coen Brothers movie is. And if you can't decide, why don't you just rank all 18 of their films? That does it for this edition of Beta. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions. Our technical director and music director is Steve Gotcher.
He's an angel! He's an angel straight from heaven!
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I've tried to be a serious man, you know?
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
He looks like a nice enough guy. It's a real shame.